people are here often, they come from public schools with the kids with no background.
Good morning and welcome back to the Court of Criminal Appeals. Good to have you all in here. We've asked to have the air conditioner readjusted. Sometimes it's hot, sometimes it's cold, but anyway, it should be cooling down in a few minutes. Before I just give you a few updates on what we have accomplished since last meeting, I wanted to introduce a few people. I'm pleased to have two of my colleagues here. I have Judge Keller and Judge Womack. And this is my new VA, Rose Maginow. And Rose has now moved to a new, this other Rose. We have lots of Roses here. Colorful and, you know, pretty place. And Rose is now in our grant office, and she is working with the grants, regular grants, and she is the program attorney for this unit. So she's the contact person for things here, and we're glad to have her in that position. We've done a few things that might seem to be small things, but we're rolling all the time. Unfortunately, a lot of people that were involved in doing some special projects have now had to be involved in helping hurricane victims. So we've had a little slowdown because of that, and thank God they're helping those people. But some of the things we've done, for example, this seems like a little thing, but one of our topics is the collection, preservation, and storage of evidence. And on that score, Jim McReynolds will speak to you about that some more, but what we have done is, if you look at the Code of Criminal Procedure, I think it's Article 2.21, if I'm not mistaken, has to do with the duties of the district and county clerks. And as you know, Judge Harrell conducted a survey of all the judges in the state to ask them what they were doing with the evidence after trial. And almost all of them just left it up to the clerks, who were throwing everything in a box and taking it up. Now, they returned the guns and the drugs back to law enforcement, but you've got your biological stuff mixed up with everything else, and therefore you've got some problems. So we called the education unit of the district and county clerks, and it just so happens that our education grant does help them. So we called them and asked them if they would be willing to let us help train their clerks so that they could separate biological evidence from regular evidence. They were thrilled. They've got three seminars, one in January, I think March and June. They scheduled a block of time for us, and DPS has been kind enough to offer the assistance of one of their people to help train these clerks in this capacity. I think that's a big, big thing. And I think that judges and lawyers probably need the same training, because if you look at Chapter 64, that statute says, with regard to DNA evidence, that the duty falls either on the attorney for the state or the clerk or anybody else, an officer of the court, to make sure that that evidence is being properly preserved. Well, if they don't know, and then we don't have some kind of joint effort to keep this evidence, we're going to continue to have a problem. So I talked to Senator Ellis and to Senator Whitmire's office about the possibility of tweaking the code so that we can have some kind of language, if necessary, to make sure that there's a responsibility to separate out this biological evidence. So we've done that. We've done some other things. One of our grantees under the grant does a particularly good job of training on whatever we ask them to do. And so K-Law put together a RIP training program, I believe it was in August, and they had a pretty good attendance and a lot of judges for a change. So we continue to request and receive help from our grantees on some of these key issues. I know that Rob's group has stepped up to the plate, and they've got lots of training with regard to Brady. So when you've got some issues there, they're stepping up to the plate, and they're going to up their training in that regard. So everybody's training, training, training. And as I told you in the first meeting, our goal is to accomplish as much of this as possible through training. TCLOS has been real good about accepting responsibility of adding to their curriculum at least best practices advice with regard to eyewitness identification. On the eyewitness identification, we're going to hear a little bit about that from Mr. Trigano later. But next time, on the 30th of October, I have Gary Wells, who's a psychologist out of Iowa, one of the nation's leading people who will speak on the psychology of eyewitness identification. We are also, I believe James McLaughlin told me this morning that Richardson is already doing double blind up there, and they have a policy on it. And so that police department is willing to come down and do a presentation on what they do. The Dallas County District Attorney's Office has agreed to put out a letter to all the DAs in the state explaining what it is that they're doing with their files. Until this last meeting, I didn't know how they had chosen those 400 cases until Craig came down and told us they were looking at the old cases where testing had been refused. So they're going to explain what they're doing and ask all of the DAs, are any of you in a like situation where perhaps you've kept some of this old evidence and you could look at your files? Just so we know where everybody is. So we've made a lot of progress in these areas, and we will continue to do so. We're going to hear from two gentlemen this morning. And before we do that, I want to let Jim McReynolds speak to you a little bit about whatever he wants to talk about. And if any of the other members have had some things that they would like to say with regard to any of these programs, I would welcome them to do so. One more thing that we've done, we continue to move on our traveling DNA show, and I had lunch the other day, Rose and I did, with Pam Bassett, who is the chair of the Forensic Science Commission, and he is going to put on his October 10th agenda with his board the concept of having legislation drawn so that we can accomplish this traveling DNA show. We've gotten a lot of help from DPS on this, and we are going to go forward with that draft legislation, and we think that the Forensic Science Commission is a good place to land these reports off these traveling labs because they are independent. And so that's what we're trying to accomplish there. So Mr. Bromwich, who, as some of you may know, was the guy that did the hit on the FBI lab and the Houston crime lab, has been very helpful and is going to give us the protocol that we're going to work into that legislation for that traveling DNA show. DPS has helped us, Pat has helped us, and Ron, who used to be there, given us a list of equipment that we'll need, because we'll need two different labs. So we're still moving, and it's a slow process. I welcome everybody to give us as many ideas as possible, and Rose and I work on it pretty much all the time, and my court has been very supportive. So thank you, and now I'm going to let Jim talk.
Well, good morning, and Barbara, let me say how much I appreciate your enthusiasm in this, and all of it's a work in progress. Certainly what I'm looking at is a work in progress, and I'm sure there are people know far more than I do about it, but what I thought I'd just kind of buy into and carve off is something that I can investigate is storage of biological evidence. Obviously, you would have to begin at the beginning of profiling a post-conviction, what crimes you would be interested in storing that evidence. And obviously, you'd have to be very mindful of chain of custody. And obviously, you'd have to have a place that we would not duplicate what happened in Houston and in other labs around the state where ultimately their evidence became corrupt and new testing had to be done. So we're a big state, and as Judge Hall said last time, you've got little counties and big counties, and evidence of maybe in somebody's attic. It may be over at the district clerk's office, and Jerry, there's even possibility there's a rape kit sitting out on the floor, and the custodian sweeping around for 2 years kicks it over and says, you know, gee whiz, let's just trash that one, and we're ultimately working on the possibility of being sure that we have not convicted someone wrongfully in this state, and evidence is a huge piece of that. What at first I thought we might do is find a suitable place or places where things could be stored properly in an area that's humidity controlled and in an area that's not flood or hurricane prone. I'm from East Texas. You don't really need one down in Bowman, I don't think, or Orange, or Missouri County, Galveston County. And then how would you properly identify so that you could get your hands right back on that information? And I kind of thought, well, you know, if we could kind of all come together and talk to quite a number of people, maybe one of the things we could do is have DPS strippers go out and collect and bring to a facility such as a TDCJ facility or something like that, this type of evidence. Make it convenient to have it around the state. I don't think that's even necessary. I had a good visit with Pat Johnson over at DPS on the telephone the other day, and we may have some things in place right now with little cost to us at all. We have 13 labs across the state of DPS runs, and it could be that as we look to see what their capacity is, that they may have storage now. You remember Prop 4 in the Constitution Amendments last time. Among some of those things were monies for labs in the state, and certainly you would have professionals there to properly label and store. This is kind of maybe a new concept for us. We're 254 counties. I'm sure there are a lot of hurdles here, and I'm sure there's many things that I've not taken into consideration at this point, so I lean to everybody in this room and others to help us as we kind of begin to look at this possibility. This is state's evidence, and wouldn't it be nice for the state to be able to help at least preserve the integrity and store this evidence. At that point, and that's a 30,000-foot flush, there are many little nuances and a lot of rabbit trails in here, guys. That there are many private labs counties like Dallas County that have maintained evidence. We saw the Houston lab blow down in 2002 and again in 2006, and you've got a lot of rural counties involved. So that's kind of, Barbara, where we are right this minute. We're going to keep looking at it as carefully as we possibly can. Carl, we'd like to kind of look over your shoulder a minute or two at the reports that you got back from the various counties. In some cases, sheriff's offices, in some cases, police offices, in some cases, district clerk's offices, in some cases, depending on what the trial did, it could be even kept by a court reporter, I understand. So there's many things we need to layer through. Barb, that's about all I've got.
Thank you. Do any of the other members want to say
anything? Yeah, I'll just say something. I'm particularly interested in both preservation of evidence, but also collection of evidence. And I know kind of what the experience is in the 13 GPS labs, but I did a survey of most of the city and county labs in the state. Got pretty good, pretty much everybody responded. And I sent them about 8 questions. I just want to go this real quickly. one of the questions I asked is, does the crime lab, how much of the evidence that a crime lab examines do they actually collect at a crime scene? And as I expected, it's less than 10%. So then further I asked them, well, is it collected by a law enforcement officer or perhaps by a civilian employee of a law enforcement agency? And generally, again, less than 10% of it's actually collected by lab personnel. And as much as the crime lab understands, most of it's actually collected by a law enforcement officer. There are exceptions. I know here in the Austin Police Department, they've got a totally civilian staff of crime scene investigators that collect all of it. But that's, I believe, an exception. I asked also how much training do the crime laboratories provide in the collection of evidence, and the response I got was that about 2/3 of them provide some training. And I asked about how many people a year they train. Generally, it's not a lot. It's somewhere between 20 and say 50 people a year that they provide some training to. I asked them to rate the what they believe the quality of the evidence they're getting. In other words, how good a job was done in the actual collection of that evidence. And the options I gave them was excellent, some improvement needed, or significant improvement needed. And 3 responses out of 7 was that the evidence was excellent, and 4 of them indicated some improvement needed. And then ask them about storage of evidence once the lab has completed the analysis. You know, what is their practice? Do they return it all, or do they store it all, or whatever? And, I got about a... our crime lab returned it. If we're examining evidence for a local law enforcement agency, we return that. And the city and county labs, basically, if they're examining, if it's a police department crime lab and they're examining evidence for their own agency, they either store it or they return it to the property room in that agency. A lot of county labs do some work for other agencies, and they return all of it. But then I asked him further, I said, well, do you save anything, and specifically DNA cuttings or latent fingerprints? And the response was almost all of them do retain DNA samples. So even if they're returning the evidence in the rape case, the rape kit and clothing, they are preserving a DNA sample. Two final questions I asked. I asked if they had any concerns about how evidence is stored before they get it, while it's in the lab, and after it's returned. And they didn't have any concern about storing it in the lab. One respondent said he's concerned that they don't have adequate storage space, which I can tell you is a problem for all crime labs. But, you know, as far as the quality of the evidence storage before they get it and after they return it, they don't really know. So, and the last question I ask is, do you believe you're receiving all of the evidence that really should be examined? And most of them said, we don't really know. But I did have two respondents that answered that, yes, they did believe they are. But I had one lab that said, no, they don't think they are receiving. And I asked him why, and he said, well, it's our lab is a fee-for-service lab. And I think that lab director's concerned that the agencies that they serve, because of money reasons, they don't submit all the evidence that probably should be examined. That is my survey as far as evidence collection.
Thank you.
I might add to that, the money reasons are a big part of it, because of the city will only get budgeted so much, the police department so much for lab services. One case can eat that whole little pot of money up, and I do think that's a real concern. Another thing about training, there are three different groups, my understanding now, in Texas that are developing pretty intensive programs for that. Texas State has started their body farm. Really what it is, because it's an interesting concept. TEKS at A&M is trying to get one started where they will do different levels of certification on crime scene, and Sam Houston State is also investigating that and starting on that. So I think we'll see an improved opportunity for training, whether or not it's taken advantage of it, I don't know.
And I spent a great deal of time talking to the chief of police from Austin. And he was very upfront saying, oh, I agree we need more training in the area of collection. We don't have enough money. And so money is a big issue. But at least with these surveys and with this information, we know we've got some work to do and at least a direction to go. So I appreciate that. Does anybody else have something we want to get?
I wanted to talk about something, a different topic. Sure. To get through that one.
Sure.
On eyewitness testimony, I got a copy of the bill that Senator Ellis drafted concerning having standards for identification procedures and then possibly videotaping or at least making some sort of tape of the procedure when you go through it. And just from my experience, and also I think it's borne out from the research that's been done, is the vast majority of cases of bad convictions have a bad identification, and it seems to be like this bill is the best thing I've seen to address that. And this, and as far as having an immediate impact on bad convictions, I think this is the first thing that needs to be addressed, because I think it would probably cut down by 50% or so of people that are getting falsely convicted if you videotape these identification procedures and you have some standards to follow. So I don't know whether or not this group would have some influence over whether or not that bill or something like that gets passed, but I would urge us to consider that to the extent that it makes some difference if we do that.
Gary, is this new legislation, or is this previously?
I got it from Ed Colfax, so maybe he can answer that for you.
Well, the draft that we just recently started circulating is a different version from the one previously submitted. It takes a slightly different approach, but still in early stages, but we can get it to everybody on the team.
Okay. Anybody else? Well, no one else has anything, then I am going to have the pleasure of introducing our first speaker, John Vasquez. John has been involved with property and evidence management for 22 years in the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, Fort Worth Police Department, and most recently with the Wichita Falls Police Department. And for the last 10 years, John has been on the board of directors for the Texas Association of Property and Evidence Inventory Technicians, and has been serving as president for the last 4 years. TAFID is a nonprofit organization dedicated to education and training people in the area of property room management. John is the owner of Mission Control Consulting Group, assisting clients in individual and organization performance, as well as labor and employment matters and property room management. So, John?
Well, good morning and thank you. I really appreciate this opportunity to come before our attendees here and especially our committee, because as Judge Hervey and I met last month, we were discussing how best TAFID, which is the organization that I'm president of, could serve this committee. And many of the issues that have been raised by Pat, by Judge Hervey, are issues that we deal with directly on a daily basis. And the reason for me coming before you all today is to make you more aware of what property room folks deal with on a daily basis. And that's what this presentation is about this morning, is awareness. Lions and tigers and bears. I don't care what evidence room that you've got, what agency you've got, whether you're federal, state, or local, or county. You've got lions and tigers and bears in your property room. Lions and tigers, that's the evidence that's coming in, fresh evidence coming in, homicide, sexual assault, that you have to be certain that are tagged properly. You've got the right chain of custody on it. With where are you going to store it at? Do you have the proper space to store it in? Those are your lions and tigers. That's the fresh evidence. Bears hibernate. So does evidence in your property room. Unsolved homicides, unsolved sexual assaults. Homicides, you're gonna have that stuff in your property room forever. You cannot get rid of it. If you don't make sure when it first comes in as a lion and a tiger, that chain of custody is there, it's stored properly. When you wake that bear up, when it's time to go to court, or when that detective comes in and says, I need this evidence, you're up the creek if you don't take care of it when it first comes in. Every agency has that. Here's an example of an agency's storage room. This is the actual storage room before we went in and did an audit and helped this agency out. Same place. You can see where they started. They've got the shelves. They're doing a great job in the beginning. But then it just becomes so overwhelming. You don't have any more place to store it. Once again, in fact, in this one slide, let's see if I can get it. Right there, there's some seepage coming through that bag, right in there. Obviously, it was not dry before being stored in the bag. These next few slides deal with specific agencies. Now, I want to make it clear, I'm not here to criticize or embarrass these agencies. This is real life stuff that has happened in police departments, and it's issues that we need to address. There was a homicide in 97, stabbing. It was ended up being the divorced husband killed his new wife's husband and right in the front yard. The wife said he got that room that night from the property room in Fort Worth Police Department. Sure enough, the mother of this of the convicted killer worked in the Fort Worth Police Department. And whenever we would have dispositions of evidence or property, if it was for destruction or whatever, she was responsible for that. That was one of her tasks. Instead of destroying it like the court order would tell us to do, she would bring those, she would take those items to her house because she felt like it's no longer a chain of custody, I can take this stuff. Well, when they went out, when our detectives went out to her place, you would not believe the inside of this house. It was full of stolen property. And we went back and traced it all, and we showed we had dispositions from the court saying to destroy it. Her destruction was taken into the house. We've got to be sure that the people we are hiring in these positions have adequate background, polygraphs, whatever it takes, because that's where it starts, is right there with those people in the property room with integrity. Galveston Police Department consultant went down there just recently. It was a mess. It was an absolute mess. The supervisor or the individual who had stolen the cocaine, the money, attended our conference last year. She was one of our members. She is no longer. But it wasn't just her actions. There was a lack of procedures, which we're going to get into here in a few minutes. There's a lack of supervision. And as the same thing with the Houston lab, it's very easy for drugs to be walking out of here at your property room if you don't have the right procedures in place.
Was that at the Galveston Police Station?
Yes. Yes. These are, this is right out of the newspapers. Where I'm getting these things from. Houston Police Department. They've been in the newspapers for the last couple of years because of some firearms that came up missing. Ended up being a telephone repairman had gone in there, saw these firearms while he was repairing phone lines for the police department and decided to walk out with the guns. Temporary employees awaiting trial on aggravated robbery charges are working in the property room. Not enough people to follow all this around. It goes without saying, and Pat can tell you this from even from the crime lab. If you don't work in that area and you have to enter it, you have somebody with them the entire time. You don't let them loose. Just for this reason, that's what they were not doing now. Hillsborough Police Department. I got a call from the chief there a couple years ago. John, I think my supervisor is stealing money out of the property room. What do I do? I said, cut up her keys and shut the place down, and we'll be down in a little bit. We went down there, sure enough, she was the only person in that police department who knew the procedures. No checks and balances there. The finance, when she was taking money over, they were not double-checking the amount of money that was in the bag. They were just taking her word for it. So she started shortchanging them. Again, procedures, deficient paperwork. There was no audit that had been done in that place for many years. Once again, today's objective, folks, is awareness, making you aware of these issues that are going on, because it's not going to stop. Historically, evidence rooms have been the black hole of the police department. They've been stuck, literally stuck in the basements. They've been the red-headed stepchild. Who can we put in there, you know, while they're waiting to be disciplined? Everybody, police agencies have looked at evidence rooms as a warehouse. Can't do that. This is something, and we're going to get into in a minute, that can make or break a police department. Storage rooms. Literally, you have some of these smaller agencies, I understand it's a money issue, but they literally have converted a closet to make it into an evidence room. Just a regular clothes closet. And of course, it's the old thing, if it's out of sight, it's out of mind. I don't care about it. That's the attitude we need to change in police departments across the state. To make or break the department, Houston is going to be many years before they get the respect back from where they are right now. Same thing with Hillsborough. Same thing with Galveston. Same thing with any other police agency that has issues with the evidence rooms. It takes one aw crap to wipe out 10 attaboys, and that's what happens when you start dealing with evidence. And let's think about it. If you don't have any evidence, you don't have a case. Pat mentioned about agencies getting full. They sure are. More items are being submitted because of advances in forensic technology and DNA. Just yesterday, I read it was an officer.com publication. There was an article in there about touch DNA. Now, Pat can tell you a whole lot more about that than I can. Basically, touch DNA is invisible stains. So you can go through there and put your hand down, there's nothing there. But as you're recreating the scene, and you think, okay, where could the perpetrator may have touched something? They can go by and scrape that area. And as long as they can get 200 to 300 cells, they've got enough for DNA analysis. Do you realize what that's going to do to property rooms? I mean, you're literally going to get the kitchen sink coming in. Because officers are being taught, and they should be taught this in the academy, it's better to get too much than to get too little, because you can't go back. But this touch DNA, it's just going to blow the grass out of property rooms. Now, I'm not here to say that we should be taking this stuff, because we need to take it if it's going to show guilt or innocence of a person. That's the bottom line of evidence. We're the ones that are storing it. But we need some place to put it. This is a major epidemic, not just in Texas, but nationwide. Where are you going to put this stuff? Wisconsin. I got a call from a reporter in Wisconsin about their lack of storage, and they were just basically shredding evidence to get rid of it to make more room for new stuff. That's not the way to do it. But what is the answer? And that's why we're glad that we have this committee to help us come up with the answers. State laws constantly changing. I'm hoping that as a result of this committee, that there's going to be a lot of laws that are going to be changing in the areas of evidence that's going to help everybody. And I will say this, Texas is leap years ahead of all the other states when it comes to laws on the books for property and evidence. Leap years. Florida, major trafficking state for drugs. Miami-Dade, police department calls me and says, John, how do you all get rid of drugs? And so I explained to her our process, and I said, well, what does your law say? We don't have any laws on that. We don't have anything to tell us how to get rid of drugs. And I was like, you got to be kidding. They've got 300 barrels, 100-gallon barrels of marijuana stored because they don't have any place, they don't know how to get rid of it. So we, by far, Texas has the best laws on the books. I mean, we can do better, and I know we can. Bottom line is more space. Now, some of the issues with more space, needing more space is not, or because we're full, is not solely because of the advances in DNA. It's because of the training. Historically, there's been very little training when it comes to property room management. Very little. And it's because of no budget. If you're a small agency, or even a large agency, and you're being allocated X number of dollars for training a year, you want that to go through. Who's going to be your first choice? It's going to be your officers, because they're the visible part. They're the ones that are out there busting down the doors, and I agree, they need that training. But go back a few slides where I said the evidence rooms can make or break the department. You need to have training for the evidence technicians as well, not just for the officers. The information gets passed down. We all know what happens when information gets passed from one person to the next. You know, something starts out black and white, and now it's going to end up being blue and yellow by the time it gets to the last person. That's the way the information gets passed down. Or to learn as you go. I don't know how many times we get phone calls from a person who they'll call us up and say, they just stuck me in this evidence technician position, and they said, handle it. I don't even know how to spell evidence. What do I do? Now, do you think that that agency is going to have a tight ship for evidence? And it's not the person's fault. Just that there's no training there. They don't know the laws. There are a ton of laws on the books, like I've already mentioned. But these people don't know it. And it's not through their fault. It's because of the lack of training. Staffing. I already mentioned. Historically, officers that are being disciplined have been sent down to work in the property rooms. Where else can I put you? I can't put you out in the street with a gun, so let's put you down in the evidence room. If they're pending IAs, let's put them down where you can't put them on the street. Let's go ahead and stick them down in the property room for a while, help them out. If they've been injured, light duty, stick them down in the property room. The majority of the items that we get in property rooms, folks, can fit into a 9x12 envelope, but we do get mattresses, we do get couches. And you stick these people with light duty, what are they going to do with it? They can't lift that stuff up. But yet, we have to deal with them working with us. Longevity. You get an officer who's been with the department for 20-some years. He feels he's obligated, or he's earned the right, or the privilege to have a desk job. So where's the chief stick him? Down in the property room. Never had any training, but that's where they put him at, down in the property room. This is a big thing. Civilian versus sworn. The trend nationally. Name me one police agency that has not said, I need more officers on the street. They always cry to their city councilmen, they always cry to the state, we need more police officers. Well, when you look at their structure, they've got sworn people in positions of record supervisors, evidence room technicians, evidence room supervisors, right on a chain. Show me in the law where it says that you need a sworn officer in those positions. Put them out in the street. Do they need to be carrying a gun with during a record supervisor's position? No. Put them out in the street. Fill that with civilians, because let's face it, you can hire a civilian at a cheaper rate than you can an officer. I don't care what agency you work for. Civilians work for a whole lot less and are just as responsible, or need to be just as responsible as a sworn. But fill those positions with civilians. Get the sworn back out in the street. And if you have any questions, please feel free to stop me throughout this thing. But civilian is the way to go on this. One of the things that we are, I am hearing about, is when you start the transition from sworn to civilian, there's sour grapes among the sworn, because they're saying, you're taking away my authority, you're taking away my responsibility, and you're giving it to a low-life, scum-sucking civilian. And that's basically how they come across. Well, last I knew, civilians have brains as well. You know, and some of us probably have a little bit more brains than some of the sworn that are out there carrying guns. But my point is this. We need to educate the sworn when we're putting them back, when we're taking them out of the evidence rooms. We need to educate them. Just don't yank them out by the collar and say, you're going back out on the street. Tell them why. And that's where that transition, that change in transition comes into play. And we're not good at that. We need to explain the reason why. We're not taking away your power. We're not taking away your authority. We're actually giving you more, because now you have more discretion in what you're doing, because now you're being a police officer. That's what you were hired to do. We can get somebody else to do this job in the evidence room. Some more issues of why we've got full property rooms. You don't have any SOPs on file. I can name a dozen, right off the top of my head, agencies that do not have standard operating procedures. Simple, how to receipt for something, how to log in, how to store it, how to package it. It's not there. what's the best way to do it? Some agencies are still doing it in the old manual log, where that's been out, that's an antiquated system for years. We need to get them into the barcoding portion of it. Much easier to audit and to do inventories on, but they don't have the basics. They don't have how to do things in there. Look at the statutes that we have to follow. Chapter 2 is the duties of the court clerk. 18, which I'm going to really get into here in a minute, is titled search warrants. And I'm not going to go through them all, but these are the different areas that we need to know about, or at least be familiar with, so we can go and research it when we have issues coming up. And some of you may be saying, well, I see transportation code up there. And I see the occupations code, section 2303, which is the vehicle storage facilities. We deal with vehicles as evidence. And there's a different way to dispose of vehicles than there is other evidence. So we need to know those procedures as well. Notification of vehicles. They're much different. Article 18 is titled search warrants. Let's look at some of the subchapters. Preventing consequences of theft. Now, this is an area that property room people deal with almost daily. Officers will see somebody out in the street, and I will need to say we do need to have some rewording done in this law. It's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. It's a nightmare. But that's a whole different presentation. We deal with these items. But it's under something called search warrants. 1817, abandoned property. Now, if I'm new to the property field, and I need, you know, I've got some abandoned property and I need to find out what to do with it, I'm going to go do a search for abandoned property. I'm not going to find it anywhere because it's hidden under search warrants. Prohibited weapons. Yes, they need to be listed under search warrants, but we also deal with prohibited weapons because whether it's prohibited or illegal, once again, dictates to us how we're going to destroy it, what we can destroy it, how we can destroy it. What do we need? We need one reference. One area that people can go to, we can put it in the occupations code. Texas Act for Property and Evidence. Simple take. Like I said, the legislation was excellent 2 years ago. That's when they came out with Occupations Code 2303. Prior to that, you had Transportation Code 682, 683, 684, 642, 643, Health and Safety Code. The four or five other laws that you had to search when you're dealing with vehicle storage facilities. Well, the legislation came through and combined everything into one, which is now the Occupations Code 2303. It's fantastic. It's got everything from A to Z that I need to know about vehicles for storage, for dispositions, auctioning them. Everything is there. That's what we need for property and evidence as well. We need one massive statute that it encompasses everything. So if I'm new and I'm coming into that property room for the first time, I can go right to my SOPs. That's going to tell me how I'm going to do it. Then I'm going to be able to go to one reference, and that reference is going to show me, it's going to tell me all the laws that I need to know. That's what we need. Dispositions. When you come to a taper conference, we give out the best procedures, the best information that we have available to us at that time, the best way to do things. When we get all done saying that, we put a big however in there at the end. And that however is, work with your district attorney. Because just like you and I are different, so is every district attorney. And how they want you to handle that evidence, what they want you to keep. Fort Worth, when I was up there, a policy for us was when it comes to keeping swatches versus an item, just keep the swatches. We don't need the entire item. Do you realize how much space that saves us? You've got a mattress versus a swatch for storage. The last agency I was with, keep the entire item. Okay, where do you want to put it? Where are we going to store it? Another thing that we want is that we need to standardize these procedures for the DAs. And I'm not saying, I'm not trying to tell, to get this committee to tell the DAs how to run their job or how to do their job. There are areas that are very common throughout the state that we can standardize so that there is no question. Because especially if you're with a county agency, you've got different municipalities that you're dealing with. And depending on how they're going to work, then you don't know what, as a property technician, you know what ends up with how to store items because they're so different. Procedures to complete disposition. What we always try to do is tell what we tell everybody is this. When that case goes to trial, attach a motion for disposition along on the back page of the can't think of it. The charge sheet. That's not the charge sheet, but it's anyway. In the back of the packet that goes to trial. Attach that. When that trial is complete, the DA then gives that disposition to the judge so he can sign off on it. He or she can sign off on that disposition to tell us what to do with it. That way there we can keep the door revolving. Because we're getting more stuff coming in than definitely going out. And there was a study that, yes, sir.
Tell me what you mean by disposition. That's a broad word. Does that mean keep or throw away?
That's what's up to the court. The court has the option, or the court has these choices to make. They tell us to either return the item to the owner, destroy it, we can dispose of it in accordance with Article 1817, which is abandoned property, or we can donate it. These are the options that the court has on the disposition. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay.
May I add, as I'm just coming to speak, biological material is a little different in the code itself. There is definite or disposition ways of doing that. And since the exonerees in 2001, by and large, or DNA, that's part of kind of, I said at 30,000 feet this morning, and as we bore down, we'll get more and more and more into this. And the whole reason for us to be here today, really, is we're looking at innocence, among other things, and ways of proper storage and so forth. But let's be mindful of the fact that, and one of the confusions I've run into is the sofa versus the swatch. What do you do with the trailer? What do you do with it? You know, in other words, this is multi-layered. It's going to take a lot of thinking and a lot of best minds to kind of help us weed through that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I don't want the impression that we're just looking solely at space, because we're not. TAPIT is not looking solely at space. We're looking at maintaining the integrity of the evidence and to be sure that the evidence that we have will prove guilt or innocence. That's what our responsibility is to maintain that integrity of that item so it can do that job. And I understand the arguments that we get from some of the different DAs that I've spoken with. Well, how do you know that, yeah, you've got some swatches, but how do you know that it's not contaminated in another area of that mattress that has not been tested yet? We don't know. So, I mean, there is a push and pull issue going on here. How do we answer that? I don't have an answer for that. But I think collectively we can come up with something that will serve the best interest of all the parties. Yes.
I'll get Marianne first.
I'm sorry.
I'm in it now, so. Defense attorneys, to me, we're not talking about them in this process. Should they have part of working with the district attorney to decide in this case, this evidence does not need to go to a swatch, or are we just going to disregard it?
No, no, they can definitely be involved in it, and they should be involved in it. And I'm
but sure how are you going to put them into the statute, and what would be, I know the details could be worked out later, but.
They are involved in this one right here, coming up, preservation of wildlife wetlands. When it comes to disposing wildlife wetlands, they are involved in it. And we're going to get to that in about one slide.
I'll go back to mine. The disposition items that are there upon the completion of the trial, right?
Yes.
The questions that we had, at least many of them, go well past that point, to a point that, you know, 15 years later, we've got new technology that's sort of something different.
Well, and
what
so
do we do on those, particularly if there's a disposition that says, you know, destroy?
Well, and that's where we come in. We bring Chapter 38, preservation of biological evidence, comes into play. Because if there's, well, let me just throw it up here. Here's the statute right here. The defendant is convicted. This chapter applies to possess by state at the time of prosecution. Whether and here's another issue that I get varying interpretations from depending on which DA I speak to. They say possessed by the state at the time of prosecution. One DA will say, well, that means items that we have already tested. That's all it applies to. Other DAs will say, well, no, that also applies to items that we have not tested that may contain or is known to contain biological material. Well, if we haven't tested it, we don't know it to contain biological material. And now with touch DNA, anything.
Now, I'm going to go beyond that, too, because I'm the engineer.
Okay.
And the engineer is going to ask a question that says, someplace off in some science lab today, mm-hmm. or some, you know, a professor's mind someplace today, there's an idea that 20 years from now may become the practical bit of this is additional information, evidence that can, should, et cetera, be used. You can prove the exactness of the company.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
What's out there?
Right now,
besides, besides the touch technology, what's out there that says other things that might be coming?
You say, you know, what's out there to say that we need to keep it?
Yeah.
Chapter 38 says it all. Because it also goes on and says, must be preserved. If they are convicted of a capital felony, and we have to keep that stuff until either the person dies, is executed, they complete their sentence, or is released on parole. So even though they get convicted, that court still cannot give us a disposition in that DNA evidence. Because this law ties our hands and says that we have to keep it. Yes. Yes.
I think we got plea bargaining coming into this issue.
Yeah, you do.
Here. And
yes, you do.
They're doing a lot of plea bargaining to go ahead and destroy the evidence that may have been beneficial 10 years out. I mean, I could get into ineffective assistance of counsel, but you're seeing a lot of this chapter spirit not being followed, probably because of space requirements. I don't mean anybody's got evil intent here, but... I'm not sure it's as absolute as the words would make it look like.
Well, there's always exceptions, and plea bargaining definitely is one of those.
We got the largest county in the state of Texas. It's the biggest exception in the world to this.
Well, I know of another county that's real close. but, I mean, this was to answer his question. What do we have in place? And this is what is already in place.
My concern is that 20 years now, 20 years ago, would we have been sitting here at this meeting talking about DNA evidence? 20 years from now, what should we be talking about today?
Well, 20 years. And in fact, correct me if I'm wrong, but in the last 20 years, we have received direction on preserving DNA from it needs to be refrigerated to it needs to be at room temperature. Back to being refrigerated, it needs to be at room temperature. On and off for the last 20 years. Am I not correct on that fact?
Yeah, when we were doing conventional serology, the thing to do was freeze it. We now know with DNA, you keep it at room temperature, it's good for 30, 40 years. So.
Yeah. So, I mean, even how we're supposed to be preserved, and even if we do it correctly, at the time that information is out to us, can change 20 years later. So it still may not be any good.
I have a question.
Yes.
You said, you know, work with your DA. These areas or the places where they're working with the DA, does the DA have input as to what you should collect in the first place?
No.
Not? Okay.
Let me qualify that sentence or that question. I have seen occasions where there is a high profile homicide that the DAs will go out to the crime scene. I have heard of cases where the DA has directed the collection of specific evidence. That is rare, but it does happen.
And the defense attorney doesn't get some input, going back to what Mary Ann asked you, as to what to keep, the swatch versus the whole mattress?
I haven't heard of them being involved at this time.
Judge, under 38, when it comes to the destruction of evidence, that's usually handled by the clerk's office. And it's ad hoc as to whether the district attorney has any input at all. That could be an automatic from the DA, from the clerk's office. Or it might be, as Mary Ann said, it might be part of a plea bargain. One of the things that defense lawyers need to do is they need to canvass every jurisdiction in the state and make sure that standard plea bargains are not including destruction of evidence, because 38 actually will work. I've gotten 38 letters asking if I agree to the destruction of the evidence. It has to be signed off both by me and the district attorney. So 38 at its best will work to preserve the evidence. The question is 38 in use?
It's not. This portion of the destruction of it, where you were talking about receiving the letter, is not widely used. In fact, it's rarely used. And what I have seen, the responses that we get is, no, don't destroy it. But it isn't used rarely. Excess quantities. This is another issue that we run up against. Meth labs, especially meth labs. About 10 years ago, there was a survey done, a nationwide survey done, and I believe it was by the International Association of Property and Evidence. On the percentage of evidence that was submitted to courts. That percentage was at 17%. Of all the evidence collected in cases, roughly 17% was actually submitted to court. When you're dealing with meth labs, I have yet to see any court accept ACC-EPT, accept meth lab evidence into their courtroom. One, they don't do it because one is very volatile. It's very odorous. And it's dangerous. I mean, just the odor itself is very dangerous to be around. So Chapter 41 and the legislation 2 years ago, once again, that's why I've got summarily highlighted, they went back, revisited that term summarily, and refined it, redefined it. And made it more clear, and that was a great start. But then this goes back to getting the DAs on the same page. Some DAs will say, keep everything. Others will say, go with what 481 tells you to go with. That's all you need. And you get some of these, you get out into the country with some of these larger meth labs, you can get a lot of material coming in. And folks, I'll tell you, if you've never been around one, you're not missing anything. It smells. It's horrible. And if you're driving past a house where you know that there's a meth lab at and you see people lying around outside on the ground, keep on driving. Because as soon as you step out of that car, it's going to get you. That's how bad this stuff is. But yet we have to hold it in our evidence rooms. We need to be able to follow 481. It's liquid. You take 5 samples. You know, it's all going to be the same, you know, it's all going to be from the top and the bottom. It's going to be there. This is more on 481. Once again, I've yet to see a court allow this type of stuff come in. When I was in Fort Worth, we were allowed to, I met with the DA there, we were allowed to establish thresholds for the amount of marijuana. Say we had a bust of 500 pounds of marijuana. They say that we could summarily destroy it up to, I mean, all we had to do was keep 50 pounds of marijuana. Everything else above that we could destroy, as long as you followed this law, this statute. For cocaine, they said anything 5 pounds and below, you keep. Anything above 5 pounds, go ahead and summarily destroy it. That was great. Other districts you go to, keep everything. What's the purpose of it? Is it for show and tell in court? Because that's the answer that we get a lot of times. We want to be able to flood the courtroom, bring in all these 50 boxes of marijuana into the courtroom so we can impress the jury. Show them pictures. It's the same thing. And it's not as unhealthy. Petition the court for reimbursement. Are we ever going to get the money? No. But at least we have it on paper in case the guy decides to write a book while he's in prison or whatever, and we can get some of the proceeds from that to help reimburse our expenses. Because I'll tell you something right now, meth labs, an average meth lab costs anywhere from $10,000 to $15,000 per lab. That's just for people to come out and pick the stuff up and carry it away. That's all it is. Health and safety in the workplace. You can definitely get a scandal with health and safety issues going on in the property room. You've got the smell going on. You've got people that are getting sick. Fort Worth, for years, people were coming in, getting sick throughout the day. They were constantly getting bronchitis and other respiratory problems. We had an air quality study done. Anybody ever heard of Aspergillus, other than Pat? This is a very toxic mold, fungi, that grows from wet marijuana that is stored or packaged up in cardboard boxes. Eventually what happens, it almost looks like dust mites coming out of the top. It just starts coming out at the seams if it's not taped properly. And it practically looks like dust mites. That's the mold. That's the Aspergillus. And people are just breathing this stuff constantly. We've had air sampling done in the Fort Worth Police Department. The levels were thousands above the norm. They spent $60,000 on an air handling unit. Now it takes two hands to open up the door to get into the evidence room because of the suction line. But you know what? The sickness has stopped. So I think that $60,000 was well spent. But that's what we need to be looking at. Like having to keep all these meth labs. Meth labs, you have to have a separate storage area. You cannot store it. You better not store it in your property room. You better have some type. We have a chemical bunker at Wichita Falls PD. It's a separate, away from the building. If that stuff explodes, you don't want the rest of your evidence room going up with it. So there's even more cost involved. And that room is even busting at the seams. Same thing with bloodborne pathogens, the needles that you get in, anything else. You got hepatitis, HIV, AIDS. That's another thing. We need to make it mandatory that if you work in a property room, you receive hepatitis shots so that you don't contract that. Right now, it's if the agency has money, you can get your shots. What's the answer to all this? Well, this isn't going to answer everything, but a big portion of it is Texas Association of Property and Evidence Inventory Technicians. When Judge Hervey and I met, she was asking some very good questions about all these issues that we're discussing right now. And I was fortunate to be able to come up Well, the majority of the answers to say, that's what TAPE does. That's what we educate on. That's what we train on. We were established in 97. We are a nonprofit. We're not in it for the money. Dedicated to the training and education of property room management. We currently have over 1,000 members. 600 plus are active. And our conferences bring 200 to 250 attendees. Now, that's a pretty good attendance when you're looking at only looking at 600, a little over 600 active members. That's because of the quality of the training. Our objectives, we want to bring, this is a professional position, professional job. This is not like a lot of people think of anymore. This is not a warehouse. This is not a warehouse. This is a professional organization, professional job. You have to know what you're doing in there, because you can make or break that department. We want to standardize the profession. We're not going to go in and dictate to police agencies how to do it, how to do their job. But there are common areas. How to package something. How to store it. How to maintain the chain of custody. These are all common areas that we can train and standardize throughout the state. We want to improve the process. Share the latest information. One of the biggest things that we really dwell on is when people show up at our conference is networking. Get to know the person that's sitting next to you, on both sides, in front of you, behind you. We have a social night, which is strictly for networking. Because it's so funny to hear people who come to our conference the first time. After the second day, we'll go up to them, because we always mingle with everybody, and we go up to them and we'll ask them, what do you think so far? Their answer is, I don't have as bad as I thought I did. Because as bad as you think your place is, there's somebody that's 10 times worse. But being able to network, get the ideas on how to do different things, that's what we're about. It's not so much just us standing before everybody, lecturing to them on how to do it. Talk with people. Get to know how they're doing things. We have recommended and actually changed some laws. About roughly 6 years ago? About 6 years ago, we went down to the legislation and we changed the law. We were able to revise the law on how to dispose of firearms. It makes it much quicker now for us to get rid of firearms. Because once again, people think about property rooms as just storing items. Well, when you get anywhere from 100, 150, 200 items per day, and that's in a small to medium-sized department, you've got to have some mechanism to get rid of that stuff. You've got to have something that's got some teeth to it. So that's what we do. We also recommend it and try to get some laws changed.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
I assume you've done a national survey, I'm sure, or you know pretty much what other states do in this regard, but you know, we have a general exclusionary rule to keep out evidence that doesn't, for whatever reason, chain of custody is failed or whatever. But do any of these, in your recommendation of changing laws in other states, in the statute itself, have some kind of a hammer built in?
No.
Such as it will not be admitted? Or are you familiar with court instructions that certain guidelines are not followed? There's a court instruction of the jury in other states?
No. When I'm talking about recommending changing laws, we're looking solely at, right now we've been looking just solely at the disposition of how can we get this stuff moved down quicker.
Well, and I'm all for the complication and the putting all of these in one chapter where everybody can get to it, but what I found is in talking to the folks in San Antonio, we're fortunate that once it gets to the lab, we're pretty well set. And as you pointed out, our main problems are the property.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking for what it is and incentive, or what is something we can do other than throwing money at it to encourage changes in the property. So I just wonder if any other states have similar type of problems.
No, because I'll be honest, like I mentioned earlier, Texas is leap years ahead of these other states. Yes, sir.
Ed Harris, Chief of Support Field Services for the Austin Police Department. I have administrative control over our laboratory, as well as of our evidence section. We are a member of the organization.
Yes, you are.
Every member of my evidence team is.
Yes.
I have administrative control over our narcotics lab, over our chem lab, over the evidence property. So we probably store more evidence in this region than anyone else. We started out with over a million pieces. We moved our storage facility from an old airport hangar on the old airport property to the new laboratory evidence facility that we built and opened in 2005 on Springdale Road. One of the safeguards you spoke about in regards to, we work very closely with the district attorney's office here in Travis County, as well as in Williamson County, in finding new ways to consolidate properties such as marijuana, grow lights, and irrigation systems, in regards to firearms, in regards to DNA evidence, in terms of how we store it, how long we have to store it, and in regards to disposals. We've been very fortunate at APD to have Rosemary Lindbergh work very closely with us, as well as Williamson County, in using those two chapters in helping us to dispose of more quickly those things we don't have to keep. DNA pretty much is forever. We understand that. But we built a new lab and facility, and we opened it in 2005. I have a 1,000 square foot narcotics vault that is popping at the seam right now. So we have all those safeguards that are built in the new facility. However, we run out of space already. So we're faced now with having the newest state-of-the-art facility for storage of these things, such as the chemicals from these clandestine labs, as well as the marijuana and the cocaine. But we can't build a facility large enough to continue the influx versus what we have in destruction orders. So the two articles that John speaks of are very effective, but what's more effective is the work that we do with the district attorney's offices in helping us speed up the process for destructions. We probably, at APD, have disposals and destruction orders for 150 firearms every month. We probably destroy 500,000 to 600,000 pounds of marijuana per month. But we would not have that process of monthly disposals if not for the utilization of those two chapters, but more so if not for the direct relationship that we have with the two DAs in Williamson County and in Travis County, and helping us speed up those processes. Detectives have a big portion in terms of releasing the property room clerks, the authority to release the information. And then the district attorney's office in saying to us, either we have a bigger problem, to be quite honest with you, in the confiscation of the irrigation systems and grow lights for marijuana plants. We have probably over one-fourth of our property evidence warehouse now is full with those systems. And we can't destroy them because they want to bring them into court for big displays. So we're currently working with the district attorney's office to allow us to take digital photos and store those within our secure digital systems to ensure the evidentiary value and safeguard of those photos, as opposed to having to store that equipment. So I just wanted to point that out.
Well, and I'm going to be honest, your issue with the wall bolting at the seams already with the drugs, it's only going to get worse. I mean, there is no end in sight to this. And that's what I'm saying, you know, nobody has all the answers to this problem. Because the more advances in technology, the more it's going to affect the property rooms. That's the bottom line. I mean, there's no other way to put it. But what's the answer? Hoping y'all can help us come up with the right one.
I pass that on to McReynolds.
Yeah, we'll work on this.
Okay.
Thank you, Gary.
Thank you, welcome.
Another one of our objectives, and I think it's just as important as all the other previous ones, is instilling pride in our property technicians. We get rid of the stigma that they are just warehouse people, that they are just low-life scum-sucking civilians. We had a banquet that we started 4 years ago. And one of the things that we wanted to be sure of was we wanted to make it special for these people. So we tell them, you have to come, you cannot come in jeans. You have to come in some type of business attire. Coat and tie for the guys, dress or pants, suit for the ladies. Just something to raise their spirits, raise their pride, and to make them proud of the profession that they're in. And that is just as important as every one of those above, every one of those previous objectives. Because if you don't have a pride in what you're doing, if you don't have the integrity in what you're doing, you don't have anything. And you don't need to be working in a property room.
John, I want to go back to something that Doug asked you just a moment ago. We have staff investigated through NCSL and other organizations any laws on anyone else's books outside of Texas. Is there anything that you know going on anywhere that deals with integrity and storage and preservation of evidence? This committee is kind of more interested in one type of evidence, probably because of innocence, than others.
Right.
And things I mentioned this morning in post-conviction, obviously. But is there any modeling out there? Is there modeling in a European country or around the world that we could, that you could point to saying this is working? I noticed your Texas Association, is there a national association?
There is a for-profit association. It's an International Association of Property and Evidence. They are the national one, but they are for-profit. I'm not saying anything against it because they're for-profit.
Sure.
I know Joe Latta, he was the founder of that. Excellent.
But do you know, in terms of other states, and you made a statement twice in here, so the answer may be absolutely no. What else is going on that we could look at outside of your organization, outside of what's taking place in the state of Texas today? And I think maybe we could summarize it by saying, everybody's doing their own thing, and we've got problems, and we need to really look at it. And I like your idea of recodifying some things. Anything else in any other places?
No.
Okay.
And one or more slides down, you're going to see exactly what I'm talking about as to why I'm saying no to your answer, to your question. Yes.
I'm sorry, John. There are two things that you could look at. The International Association of Chiefs of Police, which is the major law enforcement organization in the country internationally, just did a piece in this last month's edition dealing with property room evidence. They did a national survey and they did a national study. I would urge you to go back and take a look at that. Or if, when I leave, if I get some email addresses, I will forward them.
That would be very nice.
Also, the United States Department of Justice just 6 months ago started an initiative whereby they took $6 million and selected five major cities. Fortunately, I didn't know anything about it, so Austin wasn't one of those selections beforehand. But they took five major cities, New York, Los Angeles, Phoenix, and several others, and they threw $6 million at those cities to conduct a survey and a study dealing specifically with evidence in property rooms and their issues with biological evidence and the concerns with storage, capacity, refrigeration, with cold case storage and those things. That study is probably due to end in the next couple of months or so.
Yes.
I think that it was very extensive.
Okay.
I've read it. I passed on to my superiors. I think you would find it very enlightening, and I think it would help you from an international perspective because it is taking into consideration all 50 states. So those are two things that I would encourage you to look at.
Thank you.
And I'd be more than willing to pass on the information if I had the front basis directed to. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Hey, is ASCLAD do anything in this area?
When they accredit a laboratory, one of the things they look at is the security of your evidence.
They don't look at your real issue about keeping everything or anything like that?
No.
We're ASCLAD certified, but yes, when they come in for inspections,
yeah,
they inspect the facilities, but they don't look at capacity issues and things of that nature.
Okay. or how you could destroy and take the video pictures or
they don't. Because we'd be looking at certification issues and standards.
That's the same thing with Toledo. They will look at the same issues. We do have some top-notch training. We have evidence by the states that are coming to our state conference because they've heard about the training that we provide, the networking, everything that we provide. They want to learn from us. These are the states that have attended so far. We provide not only in property room management, but along with the management supervision, training courses, how to be a better supervisor. We bring in, there was a speaker from Colorado, I can't remember his name. He came in and talked to us on DNA for the last couple of years. Grant writing this year. Hazardous materials. A really nice thing that we started last year was this My Crime Scene, My Trial. We've established in a breakout session, we set up a My Crime Scene, going through the entire collection process, documentation, creating the chain of custody. And then on the last day of the conference, we've been able to bring in actual judges to sit in on a mock trial with prosecutors and defense attorneys. And they have a script, and then we go through, and we don't just go through the script. They also stop during it and explain why. We have testimony given, because we also want our property technicians to know how to testify. Because many of these people come in, they've never even been associated with a law enforcement agency before. They have no idea. So we also want to train them on how to testify. 4 years ago, we started a grant fund. Basically, what this is that we set aside X number of dollars each year, and we have agencies submit to us requests for equipment that they need that they can't get through their agency. Last year, we gave out about $5,000, I think it was, to agencies for equipment. This year, we're giving out a little over $4,000 to help them. We're talking little things like a heat sealer that may cost $100, $200, $300. Their agency can't afford it. It's a small agency, so we'll give them the money. We're giving $2,700 to one agency this year for a barcoding system, just to help them along. The education funding, we provide two $500 scholarships per year to either any of our members or their children that are going on to higher education. Because, once again, we are there to promote education, but we want the families and our folks to enjoy that as well. Regional training. We have gone out to other areas and conducted regional training. One of the things we do is give an awareness presentation very similar to this, but much more in depth, to police chiefs and sheriffs. And it's so funny. One of the questions I asked in this presentation, okay, let me see your hand, raise the hands of you police chiefs or sheriffs who have keys to your evidence room. And when they raise their hand up, the next question I ask them is, why do you have that? Well, because I'm the chief. I said, great. As soon as something comes up missing, guess whose name is at the top of the list as to be a suspect? And so far, I'll never forget this. This one chief looked at his assistant and said, you're getting my key back tomorrow. They don't understand. They just think it's an open room to just be able to walk in anytime. They want that, fine. Put them at the top of the list for suspects. So we give them that training as well. We also go out to agencies and do free audits for them. Now, when I say free, they're going to pay for our expenses, but not so much for our time. But we go out and we will audit their procedures. Going back to the SOPs, we always teach, if it's written in your SOP, you better be doing it. If you're doing it, it better be written. That's what's going to cover you when you have to go to court. State-specific certification, I've got an asterisk there. I have checked, and to my knowledge, Texas is the only state that has a specific certification for property and evidence room technicians. We're the first one, and we're the only one that I can find. There may be something out there, but if it is, I don't know where it's at. These are the areas that we cover: organization and responsibilities. Organization, where is it placed in the chain of command? Are you in the support side? Are you in the patrol side? Where is it placed in there? And the reason that we give them this is because it's very important when it comes to a perception of a conflict of interest. If you've got a, most of your evidence is being submitted by patrolmen or detectives. You want your patrolmen and detectives to have authority over what happens in that property. No. Because there could be a perception of a conflict of interest presented at trial. Well, your supervisor, you know, with evidence technician John, your supervisor, isn't he the one that submitted that evidence? Yes. Well, doesn't he tell you what you need to be doing all the time? Yes. Well, did you alter this? No. But you see, I mean, there's a possibility. I'm not saying it would happen. But don't even get there. Responsibilities. One of the big things we tell everybody. Your sole responsibility for working in an evidence room is to maintain the integrity of that item. And one thing that you don't care about, you don't care if the person is guilty or innocent. That's not your job. That's what you got the lawyers for. That's what you got the prosecutors for, is determining that guilt or innocence. You just want to be sure that the way that that item came in stays the same way, and you can account for every moment of that item in your possession. Room design. We also include construction and security. Room design is very important. And I say that because found property, abandoned property, can be released the quickest. Like I said, we're always getting things in, but we got to keep that door revolving. So we always tell them, when you're setting up your rooms, where you put your found property needs to be right behind your desk. So that every time you turn around, you can get rid of found and abandoned property if you don't know who the owner is in 30 days. You don't need a court order for it. You don't need anybody signing off on it. You turn around and say, oh, that thing's been here for 32 days. I can get rid of it now. So we can go to that degree of room design. Your unsolved homicides, put them in the back up on the top shelf. Keep them out of your way because you don't want to have to keep on moving them to get other evidence in and out of here. Property types, you've got different. You've got evidence, abandoned, found. Safekeeping, of course, we go into great detail on the statutes. It's about 2 or 3 hours on just the statutes alone. Dispositions and documentation. Packaging, how-to package. We actually have props there that we bring in, and we show people how to actually package these things. The right of refusal. If that item is submitted and you're already starting to see some seepage coming through that baggie, do not accept it. You have to have procedures in place to send that back, that evidence back to that detector or to that patrolman to say repackage it and repackage it properly. Personal protection equipment, PPE, gloves, tieback suits, booties, whatever it is to protect yourself. SOPs. Audits and inventories. There is a big difference between an audit and an inventory. You will be surprised at people that don't know that. We show them how to do an audit, what you need to look for. We designed a 17-page script for conducting an audit. Inventories. How to do an inventory. The best way to do it. And then we always finish up with ethics. As you've seen on some of the slides that I showed in the beginning of this, we've got an issue with ethics. And it's not unique to the property room. I mean, there's an issue nationwide with ethics, but we've got to be so careful on who we're putting in those property rooms. We've got to be careful on that. We even bring in at no charge, a former police officer from Arkansas who stepped over that line, and he spent 4 years in the state pen, federal pen in Arkansas, for stepping over that line. He comes down and gives a two and a half hour talk on ethics. He does not charge anything. When I first heard him in Arkansas, I asked him afterward, how much do you charge? He said, I'm not going to make money over my misdeeds. I said, okay, we'll cut your way down there. Well, I want you to come down and talk. He was that riveted. Excellent. But we bring everybody we can in to teach them ethics. On our certification, yes, we also have minimum requirements for somebody who can teach it. We don't just want any Joe Blow to come in and teach this stuff to them. We have up there 10-3 taker conferences. The reason for that is that we want that person who's teaching to be able to grasp our ideas, our methodologies of teaching this information, how we want, because they are representing taker. Recommendations from their agencies, recertification. Some of our future programs. We're going to be unrolling our recertification this year. This will be the first one. Next year in Austin. That's right. Next year, our conference is going to be right here in Austin. We're also going to be rolling out our advanced technician certification at next year's conference. The basic and the advanced, we want to have in the occupations code is something that is mandatory for anybody who works in the property room to be certified. The supervisor certification, we're not going to ask for that to be mandatory, but it's something that also that we are going to roll out here, probably hopefully next year. And we are in the talking stages right now of coming up with our own type of accreditation. CALEA has a good accreditation program. ASPIAT has a good one as well, but they're very expensive for agencies. They can't maintain the recertification costs on those. As a nonprofit association, we're going to be able to come up with as good of an accreditation process and be offered to them much cheaper. So that's another thing that we're, but again, we're just at the talk stage of it right now.
Yeah, John, let me just ask a question.
Yes, sir.
I'm agent to enlighten. How long does it take to get your certificate? If I come to one of your conferences and go through training, how long is your program?
The requirements for a basic technician is you have to attend one of our conferences, you have to attend the 8-hour certification course, and you have to be in the field for a minimum of 1 year.
Yeah. But 8 hours of instruction, can you learn what you need to know in 8 hours?
No. Can you learn what you need to know?
No, I understand, you know. But if certification is significant, and we're very different in this state, you understand, and as you very well know, traveling around the state, I just have to be a rural person. If you're not thinking rural this morning, you're at least talking rural this morning. What good is it if we don't have other agencies like TCLOS, or I'm just trying to think out of the box in connection with you that somehow or other, you know, everybody kind of signs off, this is what it takes. Mm-hmm. Have you made inroads into working with some of the state agencies in this, or do you try to do that? You mentioned you come to the legislature from time to time, and you've got some good ideas in terms of codification and so forth. But are you a stepchild? I mean, I don't know you.
We are new, and that's
97. What brought you about? Maybe I'm a historian. I'd like to kind of hear about where you came from.
Not a problem. The founder of TAPIC is her name is Colleen Dean. She, at the time, she was a property technician at the Hearst Police Department. She was attending the International Association of Property and Evidence Conference in, I think it was in Dallas at the time. And she and a couple of her sidekicks were there, and they just started talking. It's like, you know, this is great. This IAPD is great. It's got some great information. But it's not, it teaches us California law. We don't need to know California law in Texas. We need to have a state association. That's how it evolved.
I see.
Just from attending one of those and just having a vision. That's how it all evolved.
Was California legally required to have their organization? Was that set up in California law? Or was that
no? That was just something that the Joe Latta is now a retired police officer from the Los Angeles Police Department, okay. And he started this IAPE from there, and he just went national on it.
And we're not being critical. We're just asking.
No, I'm
trying to put the pieces together.
Jim, one of the things that we had mentioned last time about the Police Chief Association Best Practices Program.
Yes.
One of the things we do is an inspection of the property room. A lot of things we want to talk about. Is it secure? Who's got keys? Mm-hmm. We tell chief don't have keys. What's the, do an audit, do an inventory, all those type of things like that. Now, we've not gone to the certification of the technician or the person that's running the property room. I certainly think that's something we can encourage. Mm-hmm. If it's a quality certification.
That's why I was asking how many hours would it take to get it.
When we were designing this certification, that's one of the issues that we discussed was the length of the certification and the cost to the agencies, not just in money, but taking people out of their organization for X period of time.
Sure.
They can't do it. Especially you get these one officer police departments. You know, you take somebody out of that agency for 3, 4, 5 days, I mean, that really cripples them.
Do you have anything online? I mean, could a person get continuing education credits or something by completing an online course?
No, we don't have that, and we have, that's another issue that we have discussed. We're kind of shying away from that because, once again, as I mentioned earlier, the networking is so important. We view the networking on the same level as attending a conference. We view that networking as being on the same level as the conference. It's very important, and that just adds to their training and to their knowledge.
You know, within 80 miles of every Texan, there's a community college, and we use them frequently in some of the agencies in continuing education credits and testing and other things. You might want to consider at some point or another forums there.
Mm-hmm.
If in fact travel or downtime to come to a conference, those are great and everything. I'm not being critical. I'm trying to be helpful.
Right.
Those are available in the States, and you might want to, at some point or another, all of us think in terms of if we're kind of going in this direction, using those facilities.
One of the areas that we haven't been able to really expand the way that we've wanted to is because it's been a difficult time for us to get our name out. I mean, we've been in business now for about 11 years, coming up on our 11th year, and we still, how many people have heard of Taper before today? You know, that's the whole thing. Well, I know you did, Taper, you don't count. No. But as far as getting our name out there, so we haven't had the support. That's why this forum, when Judge Hervey asked if I would present something like this, I jumped at it. Because this is something I feel is going to catapult TAPIT to the next level to get our information out there, get our name out there, and get the support that we need to do what you all are trying to accomplish.
How many members do you have?
I'm sorry?
1,000. 600 active.
Yeah, we have over 600 active. And you've got 600 agencies in the state of Texas. We haven't touched all of them, but we've touched quite a few of them. And some of them are extremely supportive, like Austin. They send 5, 6, 7 of their folks every year to us. And then you've got others that they've heard of us, they don't care about us, which is fine. This is our website. We have this message blog. This thing is fantastic. People get on there almost daily and ask questions. And we guarantee a response within 24 hours from somebody. We have our events posted on there. We have our newsletter. And there's much more information that's on there. Any questions? I hope I've been able to answer all your questions. And if not, please feel free to ask me.
Thank you, John. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're going to take a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back for our second speaker. Okay.